Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Pod people, Leo Phillips here with This Must Be The Gig, your little backstage pass to the world of live music. Every single week we bring you fascinating conversations from the beating heart of the performance scene with some of the most exciting names on this big, gigantic, spongy globe. We talk passion, we talk first concerts, insights into the creative mind during this truly unusual time, and everything in the juicy center.
This week, we're excited to share a conversation with Black Thought of the Roots.
And, you know, we killed it. We won the talent show that year, and I've been hooked ever since. The rest is sort of history.
Long before he became the voice of one of the most essential hip-hop groups of a generation, Tariq Trotter started performing on the streets of Philadelphia with another young man named Amir Thompson. Not long later, the duo stood at the fore of a massively influential band, now going by Black Thought and Questlove. The Roots made a splash quickly, kicking off in the early 90s and reaching the platinum echelon with 1999's classic Things Fall Apart. That strength has only continued to grow for decades, with Black Thought's diverse list of credits now including the Roots' role as Jimmy Fallon's house band on Late Night. Now Black Thought is set to release his third solo project, Streams of Thought Volume 3, Cain and Abel. Due October 2nd, the record spans a vast array, showcasing Thought's unique vocal skill alongside production from Sean C and features including Pusha T and Portugal the Man, among many others. In this chat, Lior spoke with Black Thought about what he and Questlove learned while performing as a duo, how the pandemic has shifted his pre-show routines at Fallon, setting Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band as a goal in the Roots' rise, covering DeBarge as a teenager, and so much more. So let us not be delayed, this is Lior and Black Thought. Enjoy!
At Fallon at the moment?
Yes.
So what time do you often get there before the show starts to record? How many hours before?
I usually arrive at around 1:45. I take a COVID test that I get the results by 2 or shortly after 2. And then I'm here. We usually have a rehearsal between 3 and 3:30. And then I just sort of hang around until we shoot the show, which most days is around 5:45.
Wow. Okay. So what do you do when you're like hanging around? What do you, are those moments?
When I'm hanging around, I read books.
Tony.
This is what I do in my downtime. This is a really good one.
Becoming Supernatural, Dr. Joe Dispenza.
Yeah. I do that. I shop online. I write songs and stuff and just kill time. I'm used to sort of, being more interactive with the rest of the staff and the other members of the Roots, but there's only like one person per room. Maximum occupancy now, so we can speak to each other at a distance in the hallway, but aside from that, there's not much the way we fraternize and socialize.
Sure.
Is very, very different now.
Yeah, I think it kind of, obviously it's a new way of living, but it certainly makes you appreciative of the times that we had when we were like coughing and sniffing and hugging. Yeah. And right?
Absolutely.
Like when you travel and things like that, how OCD are you with germs and stuff? Like, do you normally wipe down counters, and are you like aware of how gross humans are normally? Or is it just from COVID that you are thinking twice?
No, this has been great for me because I've always been sort of a germaphobe, not to the extreme, but I've always been, you know, sort of wiping things down and, you know, just conscious of touching my face and keeping my hands clean and everything because I'm a singer and I've, you
yes.
know, gone through sort of being sick on the road and not being able to use my voice. And if I can't use my voice, then I'm not the only one who sort of suffers. So, I've always been just more conscious of that and been a bit of an introvert and a bit, a little bit to myself, but I'm also social. But, you know, I feel like this, I'm as close to sort of an ideal fit as one, almost as close as one could come for these, the current sort of precautions that we're having to take.
I think there's something about, like, as a singer and an artist that you know, as you are, that also you start thinking about how isolated that creative process is anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you spend a lot of time rightfully, you know, with socializing with people, collaborating with artists, reading, writing, your brain's constantly going. But to be honest, you are so good for this almost because you are in your own space often. You're in the recording studio, backstage, preparing, things like that. Did you think about things like that? How lucky you are in the sense that you don't have to be teaching yourself or reteaching yourself how to be in this time?
Yeah, I'm very thankful. And, you know, every day I sort of, I acknowledge that, even if it's, you know, just to myself, the gratitude that, it's been a lot to sort of get used to, it hasn't been a huge awkward amount of adjustment for me.
Sure.
You know, to do my work. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your work. I mean, this is why we're here, and, you know, blessings and celebrations for the new record that's coming out.
Oh, thank you.
It's such a great thing to have out in the world. And then, you know, you look at, like, you're now at the third installment of Streams of Thought. So how does it feel to be sharing this set of tracks? Were they all written at the same time, or did you want to, work on them separately?
Yeah, they were, I worked on them separately over a few different sessions. Maybe, I want to say maybe five or six sessions during which I was writing that Sean C and I worked together. We did a few sessions in New York. And then we traveled to work with Portugal the Man in Portland, Oregon over a weekend or so. And then there's also a song that we recorded at a time when we both just by, I guess, coincidence, happened to be in LA at the same time. So we recorded one of the songs in LA.
Wow.
But yeah, aside from that, we didn't spend that much time on any of it. That's sort of the concept of Streams of Thought. It's about, almost like working on impulse and just not overthinking things. So it's as close to a stream of consciousness as we could get.
Why is it important for you to approach your art that way? That might sound like a silly question, but why is it important to have those stream of consciousness moments that you can just let everything out, be open, be candid and honest? Why is that important for you as an artist, and why is that important right now?
For me, I think, you know, it's just important to show at, you know, at this point in my career, I want to, you know, whatever I do, to be sort of demonstrative of my range. So, you know, there's that. But yeah, you know, the way I work in a roots capacity is just very different. You know, people say, hey, you know, you're working, you're recording, your lyrical content is relatively, comparable to what you do working with the roots. So how is this different? And, you know, what's different about Streams of Thought is that these are songs that are written and recorded on instinct. So I'm able to listen, you know, to my true self and sort of go with my first, you know, thought. You know what I'm saying? No pun intended. But the way that we've always worked as the Roots is sort of trying to, you know, I guess we've actually worked sort of worst case scenario.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
Just thinking of, well, what's the worst thing that could happen? So let's sort of prepare for that.
Put that out there, yeah.
And accommodate for it. And, you know, in this sort of configuration of you know, how I've been, you know, making my music, it's sort of the antithesis to that. So it's more, it is more honest. It is more personal and vulnerable and, you know, open in a different way. So I'm able to sort of, you know, it's the best of both worlds. It's not like the Roots is over, and it's not like I'm not working on new Roots material as well. But this is just, you know, the way I'm able to compartmentalize and differentiate between the two, you know.
Literally, we're speaking from backstage in your, you know, dressing room at Fallon. It's you clearly can multitask and do, you know, different things, to solo stuff, to band stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think my curiosity is in why it's different. I think it's more, what do you get out of it? That is so important for you as an artist to be able to, you know, like even looking at Good Morning, it's such a strong track with Pusha T and Killer Mike and Swizz Beatz. And, you know, you mentioned Portugal the Man, like you have these collaborators, but it's so you, it's so authentically you speaking to the listener. So why is that valuable for you to do now?
I think for me, it's cathartic, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm able to sort of serve as my own therapist in very many ways. And this is sort of, you know, what I have to get, you know, I have to get it out. And the medium that in which I work is also ever evolving. You know, sometimes it's music. Sometimes it's just some remarks that I have to write down, or, you know, it's a visual thing, or, you know, the photography or the culinary arts or something
regarding
fashion, or, you know, but I have to create. And once I've created something and it's been received, then it's, you know, a certain level of gratitude that I get. And it's reassurance, it's confidence building. It's, you know, it adds on to my awareness, and, you know, it patches me in that much more further when it's time to sort of repeat the process. So this is what I do, and this is what we do, because we have to.
I love what you said now about that it patches you into that awareness, because a lot of people shy away. They want to use it to escape, and that you are doing it to tap in.
Yeah.
It's so powerful, but it's also so emotionally not only draining, but like you've got to bare your soul to yourself.
Yeah.
And how do you navigate that and make sure you're not going fucking crazy? And, you know, how do you make sure that you're okay?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. But I think, you know, the reward, you know, there's a certain level of, you know, consciousness that one is able to reach, you know, as you just come more aware of sort of, you know, the space that you occupy and the space that we occupy, and, you know, the space that is space, and how much of sort of the universe is dark matter. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you deal with that on a certain level, I feel like it affects people, you know, usually one of two ways. Like sometimes it's completely overwhelming. In the way that the overlook effect, what is called the overlook effect, is overwhelming to astronauts and people who travel, you know, out into the solar system, people who travel to the moon and out into space on shuttles and stuff to set up satellites and that whole deal. Like when they get that far away from the Earth, outside of the Earth's atmosphere, to look right back upon, you know, the planet. It sometimes it makes them go batshit, you know.
Right. Right.
So yeah. So it can affect you that way, or it can affect you in another way, which is almost the opposite, which is a way that makes you appreciate, you know, sort of the role that you play as, you know, one of the small minute pieces of, mm-hmm, you know, another sort of microcosm. And it makes you appreciate, mm-hmm, just a greater connection. And I feel like it speaks to working in tandem and working in unison, and, you know, sort of, you know, just there being like the grand scheme of things. And that's, you know, calming in very many ways. It's just a consciousness of, you know, the galaxy and the intentions that the galaxy has, sort of being greater than, you know, any one man or any one, you know, city, any one, you know, country, continent, whatever, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There are far more powerful forces at play, you know?
Pause the podcast!
It's time to step away from the conversation with Black Thought ever so briefly to share a special segment. We typically like to share our favorite live show or live stream of the week, but we want to continue putting a spotlight where it's most needed and instead highlight an organization we think you should contribute to. This week, we're highlighting the Black Roots Alliance, an organization that supports the safety and liberation of all Black people, promotes Black leadership, and cultivates Black-centered community transformation. To learn more and contribute, head to blackrootsalliance.org. That's blackrootsalliance.org. But for now, back to Lior and Black Thought. Enjoy!
I mean, I remember being blown away the first time I learned about the legendary stories of you and Questlove as, you know, like a street performance duo in Philadelphia. I was, you know, I'm from South Africa, so like hearing how that was something, you know, those experiences and how fulfilling they were. Were those experiences, were you looking at it more as a trade that you could adopt to like fill other creative work, or did you find that experience really telling for how you got to where you are now?
I definitely think the experience of, you know, the way we sort of worked together as young people and the way that the Roots Collective came to be, mm-hmm, was sort of the precipice. Like it was, you know, it is because of, you know, the way we worked and when it all, you know, sort of was taking shape that we're able to sort of be all things to all people, you know, now, and that we have been, you know, throughout our career. So yeah, I think our career has definitely been reflective of having sowed those initial seeds of, mm-hmm, sort of being able to code switch and being able to perform for, you know, different audiences, sometimes, you know, multiple different audiences during the course of one day or evening.
Yeah.
And, you know, having to sort of to grab folks' attention and be able to hold it and, you know, to maintain, you know, your rapport, your connection to the audience, sometimes without amplification. So I think that speaks, ooh, to just the, you know, the how dynamic our performance has sort of evolved to be. And yeah, this was all, but even before we had taken it to the street, we were in high school where that was one of the focuses, was the performing.
Right.
The performing arts. You went to the high school for the creative and performing arts. And I feel like having formed our band there, the career path that we've taken, you know, ever since has, you know, always sort of spoken back, you know, has been a nod back to that sort of origin story,
Yeah, and a lot of the MCs that I've talked to have mentioned cyphers and freestyling with school friends being that real hook for the performance side of, oh, yeah, of their lives, in addition to the writing side. You know, a lot of people cite that moment and that those formative years as, I was really just trying to respond to my friends talking shit, or I was just really trying to add in what I thought I was going through and what I was feeling. So what was your experience with that part of rap?
You know, I was always super competitive and always surrounding myself with, you know, artists that I had a great deal of respect for, and people who I felt I stood to learn something from. My sharpness, you know, the people say steel sharpens steel. So it's important who you surround yourself with as a creative, because it's going to, you know, be reflective of, you know, the way in which you're able to create and you know, just, you know, the broadness of your scope and, you know, what your vision is going to be. So I've always just tried to, you know, interact and integrate myself into collectives of the best, you know what I mean? The best that would, whatever place and time I happen to occupy sort of has had to offer.
So what was the first time then that you performed in front of people? Do you remember that first gig that you ever played, that very, very first one?
My first time performing was in the third or fourth grade.
Wow.
It was a talent show at school. And, you know, I did a cover. I was in a group of about, you know, four other students. And, you know, I did a cover of a song by DeBarge. Are you familiar with DeBarge?
Yes. Why did you choose that as a cover?
They were popular back then. And, you know, the girls liked DeBarge. That song, you know, their music was on the radio, you know, every 5 minutes. And I did a DeBarge song. And it was well received. We did a great job. We had some cool harmonies. But I think there were some folks who, like, did a dance routine to some hip-hop music, like an early version of hip-hop, which was more like, you know, just electronic music, you know, Tour de France by Kraftwerk or, you know, something like that.
Right.
And, you know, they did this dance routine, and the response that they got from the audience just let me know that the next opportunity I had to perform, I was going to rap. Because I already, you know, I've been writing rap since I was about 9 or so. So I was, you know, a couple of years into having been a writer. But I'd yet to really to perform in front of an audience, so to speak. I, you know, performed at parties, you know, a little bit here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided the next time I competed in a talent show was going to be a rap thing. So in what must have been the fifth grade talent show, or, you know, fourth or fifth grade talent show, whatever was the next year, I got a rap group together. And it was me, it was two other rappers, a friend of mine named Waleek, mm-hmm, a friend of mine named Dwight, who would later go on to become an icon in his own right. He was the rapper Beanie Siegel.
Wow, that's such a young age that you met everybody.
Yeah. Young age, and he was younger than I. He was a year younger than I was. But this was both of our first sort of performance, and we had some break dancers and someone who did the human beatbox.
Wow.
And people doing graffiti, like street art, live on stage. So we just brought every part of the hip hop culture to the audience. Everything except the DJ. We didn't have a DJ because we performed to a track. But and you know, we killed it. We won the talent show that year, and I've been hooked ever since. The rest is sort of history, you know.
Wait, what DeBarge song did you cover? Was it Rhythm of the Night?
No, this is before Rhythm of the Night. This was, I think we did Ooh and I Like It.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. That's so funny. But were you ever, like, I don't want to project this onto you, but, like, what were you performing for? Were you performing because it felt so good to express yourself like that? Or were you performing because you were good at it and you just, that was your calling in life?
I think performing was my calling. I'd always been a performer, you know. I would, you know, perform for my members of my family, and you know, if they had guests came over, I would, you know, put on suits and, you know, dress up in outfits and come out and sing. And some of my friends on my street, we would do, you know, get together and sing doo-wop songs. And
sure.
You know, I'd always been a performer. So I think it was just in me. And like I said, you know, it was something that, you know, I sort of had to make manifest, or, I would have probably gone insane.
A lot of people ask, like, how do you get into a certain vocation? How do you get into a certain life stream? And that you got into it because that was just in your blood.
Yeah.
Start. So, I mean, I know early on you also performed at like Lollapalooza and Montreux Jazz Fest and like,
yeah.
Gosh, like Woodstock 99. So do you have any particular memories from those festival performances? Because those are very different to, I mean, you were describing now one of your first performances being this all-encompassing thing with a beatbox and a track and dances and things like that. But going to a festival is a completely different beast almost. So what kind of memories do you have from playing at festivals, and does it really differ much to those early days for you as a performer up on stage?
Right up until you know, those first runs of shows like Lollapalooza, Smoking Grooves tour, and you know, performing supporting Cypress Hill and Beastie Boys, who took us out on one of our first runs. You know, we were like sponges. So we looked and learned and absorbed, you know, sort of, you know, what to do, what not to do, how to move on the road, on stage, as a unit. And, yeah, like we learned those lessons, and, yeah, we would apply those lessons almost immediately to our own working model. Yeah, and you know, that was the days of which you speak have come and gone, but I feel like those of us who were sort of around during that period, you know, we're cut from a certain cloth. Like, you know, we're road warriors. We're able to, you know, there was no, you know, like, we paid our dues. We come from, you know, you're lucky if there's a hotel room for, you know, any member of the band. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You know, having to park the bus up, and then we'd all go into a hotel, and it's like, oh, we have an hour for everyone to take a shower, and then we have no more access to this room. You know what
God,
I mean?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, we sort of paid, you know, I mean, traveling Europe in a van, not a bus, and, you know, driving ourselves around the States.
Oh my God.
All that, you know what I mean? The stuff that is the stuff of legend, though. And it just makes you appreciate whatever it is that you're able to achieve. When you achieve it, you're able. It makes you appreciate it more, and it makes you more appreciative of the brotherhood and the camaraderie that is built, you know, through the struggle. Like when you struggle together with someone to achieve a goal.
Previous two were just the first, you know, streams of thought. But then this last one coming up in a few days' time is Cain and Abel. Mm-hmm. What made you put a title on it?
Naming this volume, Cain and Abel, I feel like it speaks to just where we are in society, and, you know, definitely our relationship with one another here in the United States. You know, brothers killing brothers. You know, man killing man. I just feel like it speaks to mortality and to the fragility of life and, you know, the original sin, so to speak, in that way. But, also just on a more, straightforward level, we are Cain and Abel. Sean C, who produced, this material, his name is, Sean Cain, and it's spelled the way that we use it in the title, Cain, and I am, you know, I am able. I'm willing.
You yourself are, of course, considered a legend, and you've collaborated with so many over the years.
Yeah.
It's a difficult question, I know, but do you have somebody, I mean, you mentioned earlier touring with Beastie Boys and Cypress Hill, but was there a band or someone that you saw live that you later collaborated with that kind of blew your mind, or just in general, an artist that you worked with that really shifted the way you work?
I mean, there's been so many. Beastie Boys, Rage Against the Machine. This tour that we did with Beck made a huge impression on me, a lasting impression. Very many other runs that we did with Cypress Hill, Public Enemy, The Fugees, Outkast, George Clinton, and different sort of variations of his Parliament ensembles, P-Funk All-Stars and that whole thing. But yeah, you know, someone who we saw perform a long while ago, and you know, they've always made a lasting impression on us was Bruce Springsteen and the Street Band, and just, you know, what he, you know, means and what he has meant for so long, for so many people. There's definitely been something to sort of that we've aspired to. And
we used to do this festival. It was called Roskilde,
which is in Denmark.
Denmark,
yeah.
That's a festival. As a part of which, we were able to sort of work our way through the ranks, and we worked our way up, you know, over very many years, playing each individual stage and sort of, you know, killing it and approaching it with the same level of confidence and professionalism and, you know, rocking our respective audience for years until, you know, one year we came back, and it was, you know, we were on the main stage, and it was just the Roots and Bruce Springsteen. And I, you know, had
a God.
I remember when, you know, we couldn't even get over here to the stage, and now we're sharing the stage, and we killed it. We, you know, destroyed our set so crazy, you know, with Springsteen and those guys watching, that they had to bring us back out during their performance. They're like, you know, there's no way we're going out there. They had to bring us back out. And yeah, you know, that was a moment for me. That was a moment to sort of reflect upon. And, you know, with Questlove and I, well, he had to leave immediately because he had to DJ. So he missed coming back out with Springsteen. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, after the whole thing had taken place, it was something that, you know, we still reflect upon as a milestone, sort of watershed moment. You know?
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kivel. We'd like to thank Dean Berger and Daniel Brater for additional music, as well as the Consequence Podcast Network. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod. And generally, just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.